Welcome to Healthy Versus Toxic, the podcast where licensed mental health professionals explore what makes a relationship healthy or unhealthy or even abusive, all from a scientifically informed perspective.
Hello, this is Dr. Grande. Today's question asks, what is dependent personality disorder? Now, this is a personality disorder that I've covered before in a few videos, but a lot of the questions I've received recently about this particular personality disorder are really looking for a comprehensive description. So the history of the disorder, the course of treatment, what's unusual about the disorder when comparing it to other disorders, comorbidity, and clinical utility. So I'll be covering really a lot of aspects of dependent personality disorder in this video that goes well beyond what I've covered before. So DPD is a cluster C personality disorder. It's in the anxious, fearful cluster. There are two other personality disorders in that same cluster, avoidant and obsessive compulsive. So obsessive compulsive personality disorder is different than obsessive compulsive disorder. One's a personality disorder and one's not, but there are a lot of other features that distinguish them as well. So with DPD, we see 8 symptom criteria listed in the definition of the diagnostic and statistical manual. And 5 of these criteria must be met to receive a diagnosis of dependent personality disorder. So looking at these symptom criteria, we see someone who has difficulty making everyday decisions without an excessive amount of advice and reassurance from others. They need others to assume responsibility for most major areas of their life. They have difficulty expressing disagreement with others because of a fear of loss of support or approval. They have difficulty initiating projects or doing things on their own. This isn't because of a lack of self-confidence, but rather it's because of a lack of motivation. We see they go to excessive lengths to obtain nurturance or support from others to the point of volunteering to do things that are unpleasant. They feel uncomfortable or helpless when alone because of exaggerated fears of being unable to care for themselves. They urgently seek another relationship as a source of care when a close relationship ends. And they are unrealistically preoccupied with fears of being left to take care of themselves. So dependent personality disorder is interesting for a variety of reasons. It's not studied very much. If you compare it to the other personality disorders, we see a lot of them get a lot more attention. Like 3 of the cluster B personality disorders get a lot of attention: borderline, antisocial, and narcissistic personality disorders. The 4th cluster B personality disorder is histrionic personality disorder. This one doesn't get much attention either. But again, in the research literature, a lot of attention is focused on those other 3. So much so that dependent personality disorder kind of gets lost. We don't really see much on it at all. In terms of its definition, we see that people have to depend on one another to survive. So it's really talking about pathological dependence, sometimes called maladaptive dependence. It's when dependence is taken too far, so far that it interferes with functioning. However, clinically significant distress is not required as part of the definition for dependent personality disorder. So the diagnosis could be present without a lot of distress. Now with DPD, sometimes this disorder gets confused with codependence. So we have dependence versus codependence. And some people have asked, why isn't there a codependent personality disorder listed in the DSM? So there are a number of differences between the idea of dependence and codependence. But what's important here for looking at DPD is the idea that somebody with DPD is dependent on somebody who can provide for some of their needs and isn't necessarily dependent on them. So it's a one-way dependency relationship. Codependence, of course, what we see there is somebody's dependent on another person, and that other person is also dependent on them. Even though they might be relying on each other for different needs, like to have different needs met, it's still codependence. So really, if somebody's codependent and they meet 5 of the 8 symptom criteria, we would usually just say they have dependent personality disorder. There is no, again, codependent personality disorder. Codependence and dependence aren't really separated for the definition of DPD. So if we look at the history of this disorder, we see that dependent personality disorder really comes from the psychoanalytic school of thought. So, of course, this was started by Sigmund Freud, but a number of other people have engaged in research and practice using psychoanalytic theory. And nowadays, most of the time, we see it referred to as psychodynamic theory. So there are some changes to it, and it became psychodynamic. We see that in DSM-1, the first Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, published in 1952, there is no DPD at that time. There is a passive-aggressive personality, passive-dependent type. That's what we had in 1952. So really kind of a complex way of expressing dependent personality disorder. This particular type of passive-aggressive personality was characterized by being indecisive, being helpless, and having a tendency to cling to others. So a much simpler definition in use in 1952 than we see now. And DSM-II in 1968, in addition to that passive-dependent type of passive-aggressive personality, we also see hysterical personality. This construct would later become histrionic personality disorder, and we see that it contains a part about how people with this disorder would often be dependent on others. It's not until DSM-III in 1980 that we first see dependent personality disorder as a separate disorder. And back then it only had three criteria: allowing others to assume responsibility for important decisions, putting one's needs behind those of the person upon whom one depends, and lacking self-confidence. These criteria were greatly expanded for DSM-3R, which was published in 1987, but the lack of confidence symptom was dropped for DSM-3R. We don't see many changes to this disorder as we move into DSM-4 in 1994, and it was almost dropped from DSM-5, which was published in 2013. It's interesting because the Personality Disorders Workgroup asked for it to be dropped, but the American Psychiatric Association Board of Trustees chose not to follow that recommendation. So in DSM-5, dependent personality disorder is still an official mental disorder. Now, the research literature tells us that DPD is heterogeneous, right? So what this means is there's no core manner of presenting with this disorder. There's a lot of variation in presentations. With 5 of 8 symptoms required, we see that there are 93 possible combinations of symptoms that can lead to a diagnosis of DPD. Now, mental health counselors and other mental health clinicians are generally able to identify DPD criteria about 70 to 75% of the time. That's not ideal. Ideally, it would be a little bit higher than that. Well, ideally, it'd be much higher than that. But the cutoff is usually considered around 80%. We want clinicians to be able to accurately identify criteria for a disorder 80% of the time or better. But overall, DPD doesn't hold up too badly when compared to other personality disorders. Even though it is heterogeneous, a lot of the other personality disorders are heterogeneous as well. Factor analyses of DPD show that it appears to be two-dimensional: incompetence and dysfunctional attachment. Those are the two dimensions or domains of DPD.
Hi, I'm Matt Harris. Seton Tucker and I host the podcast Impact of Influence, which for 2 years covered in depth Alec Murdoch, who was eventually convicted in 2023 of murdering his wife Maggie and son Paul. That story continues to evolve, and we will cover that. Plus, we will tell you stories of other true crime events that have happened in the South. Please join us on Impact of Influence and give us a follow on the Impact of Influence Facebook page.
Greetings from Evergreen Podcasts. We're rolling out a listener survey, and we want to hear from you. The information in the survey will help us gather statistics and in turn make our shows more appealing to advertisers. I know most people don't like ads, but this is one of the only ways our shows make money and help keep their lights on. We promise it will only take a few minutes, but the impact on our podcasts will be tremendous. As a token of our appreciation, we'll randomly select one lucky participant each month to win an exclusive merchandise package from Evergreen Podcasts. Head to evergreenpodcast.com/listener survey to help a show and possibly get some free stuff for doing so. We can't thank you enough for the support. Now back to the show.
So from a personality point of view, using something like the 5-factor model of personality, so openness to experience, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism, remembered through the acronym OCEAN, we see that DPD is associated with high neuroticism. This is what really stands out when looking at the 5-factor model. This stands out above all the other associations. Specifically, we see strong positive correlations with 4 of the facets of neuroticism: anxiety, depression, self-consciousness, and vulnerability. Looking at the other 4 traits, we see low openness to experience, low conscientiousness, low extroversion, and high agreeableness. Now, DPD can be easily confused with a number of other disorders like avoidant personality disorder, borderline personality disorder, and histrionic personality disorder, as well as a number of other mood and anxiety disorders. It also has significant comorbidity. We see comorbidity with the other two cluster C personality disorders, again, avoidant and obsessive compulsive. There is so much comorbidity, in fact, with avoidant, that some have argued that avoidant personality disorder is really the same thing as dependent personality disorder. But the evidence actually suggests the two are distinct. A quick look at similarities and dissimilarities between DPD and APD tells us that both disorders are characterized by believing that other people are better or more competent. Both have self-blaming behaviors and low assertiveness. Both feature avoidance and compliance, and both emphasize being criticized or rejected as a central fear. We see that DPD has that low extroversion that I talked about, but avoidant personality disorder, APD, has a much lower level of extroversion associated with it. Also, DPD is associated with high levels of employment. People with this disorder have a fairly high likelihood of being employed. That's not the case with avoidant personality disorder. Now, the key difference between DPD and APD is really considered to be motivation. With DPD, somebody is anxious about being left alone. We don't see this with avoidant personality disorder. And also, people with DPD tend to believe that others who are considered better will come to their aid, whereas people with avoidant personality disorder, again, believe that there are other people who are better, but they do not believe that they will come to their aid. As I mentioned, DPD is highly comorbid with borderline histrionic personality disorders. All three are characterized by pathological neediness. And dependent personality disorder has comorbidity with mental disorders that are not personality disorders, like panic disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, social anxiety disorder, major depressive disorder, and eating disorders. It's important to keep in mind the seriousness of a lot of these other disorders that are comorbid with DPD, because this is something I'll talk about when I get to clinical utility. Now, how about the etiology of DPD? What this means is, what causes this disorder? Well, we don't really have much information about the etiological factors with DPD. We think that trauma in early childhood may be predictive of developing this disorder. We also know that fearful attachment style appears to be a fairly strong predictor. This style has low assertiveness and high social anxiety. Separation anxiety disorder may also be an important risk factor for DPD. If someone has separation anxiety disorder, they are 10 times more likely to develop dependent personality disorder. DPD is more often diagnosed in females as opposed to males. This is a particularly controversial aspect of this disorder. Some researchers have argued that this diagnostic pattern is because clinicians are biased in terms of the way they view gender and DPD. They view DPD symptoms as more maladaptive when presenting in females as opposed to males. Interestingly, males who commit uxoricide often have DPD. Uxoricide is when a man kills his wife. Also, DPD is a stronger predictor of suicide when it appears in males as opposed to females, but both males and females are at high risk when we talk about DPD. So how about the course of this disorder? What do we expect to see with DPD in the long run? Well, again, we don't have a lot of information about DPD, and we certainly don't have too much on this area of course. But it may be that this disorder actually gets a little worse over the lifespan in terms of symptom severity, which is different than what we would expect to see with a number of other personality disorders, including borderline and histrionic personality disorders. And again, those are highly comorbid with DPD. In terms of the treatment of DPD, one of the most popular types of treatment would be cognitive behavioral therapy. So a modality that challenges irrational thoughts and beliefs and introduces more useful thoughts. We also sometimes see existential therapy used to treat DPD. DPD is considered to be more responsive to treatment than many of the other personality disorders. Counselors often consider individuals with DPD to be more cooperative, friendly, and less likely to end therapy prematurely. But also, there may be a tendency here for clients with DPD to stay in therapy longer than needed, which makes a lot of sense if we think about the nature of this disorder. Even though DPD seems a little easier to treat and it's more responsive to treatment, treatment gains are typically modest. So what about this theory that DPD has low clinical utility, right? So what this means is the classification itself doesn't really help clinicians to help people, right? It doesn't seem to do a lot of good to have this disorder in the DSM. That's one of the theories anyway. Remember I talked about before how this disorder was almost dropped from DSM-5. Now, evidence does support the disorder should be an official classification. The symptoms do hold together well, even though it doesn't have as strong an association with low functioning as with many of the other personality disorders. There is this risk of suicide I talked about before, so the disorder should be taken seriously. But I can understand the argument for low clinical utility. Sometimes we look at this issue with this question. How often is somebody who has the disorder successfully treated? So this is actually a complex question because there are a lot of stages between when a person in the population has a disorder all the way through to when that person receives successful treatment. So if you have a person in the population with DPD and you're thinking all the way through to successful treatment, first, they would have to recognize that something is wrong. Insight with dependent personality disorder is higher than average when compared to other personality disorders. But again, we don't see low functioning as often. So many with the disorder may not feel like they need treatment. Second, in treatment, they would have to be correctly diagnosed, which could definitely be a problem with a disorder that has symptoms that are less obvious than a lot of the other symptoms associated with other personality disorders. Third, DPD would need to be the focus of treatment. So even if somebody went into treatment, even if they were correctly diagnosed, it would still need to be the focus of treatment at some point during the time somebody was in counseling. And because of the high comorbidity, the high co-occurrence with a number of other disorders, serious disorders, like I talked about before, like BPD, OCD, PTSD, MDD, and GAD, it would seem that much of the time, DPD is going to be fairly far down the list, right? Those other disorders are often considered more serious. And again, their symptoms may be a little bit more obvious. So the client and the counselor are likely to want to focus on those other disorders and not put a lot of energy, at least initially, into working on the symptoms of DPD. Now, interestingly, we do see some research that indicates that if a person with DPD has comorbidity and the other disorders are treated, sometimes that same treatment will help reduce the DPD symptoms. Fourth, the treatment has to be successful. So again, in this chain of events that occurs to help somebody with DPD, the treatment would have to work. It would have to help reduce the symptoms, the severity, duration, and frequency. Because DPD is not studied very often, we don't see a lot of research around what treatments would be effective in treating that disorder. And there aren't many counselors who have a lot of experience treating dependent personality disorder. So the bottom line is, a lot can go wrong between somebody appearing in the population with DPD and that same person being successfully treated for those symptoms. So clinical utility isn't just about how well constructed a definition is of a disorder, but there are a number of other important factors. Somebody might be discouraged from seeking treatment. Somebody may not be treated effectively, even if they are in treatment. So we have to keep a lot in mind when we look at the construct of clinical utility. It's not always an easy construct to address. So dependent personality disorder is an interesting disorder. It's not studied very often. It's not highly prevalent in the population, but it can have serious consequences, and it has a lot of comorbidity and other factors that make treating it somewhat difficult. So it's a disorder I think clinicians should study. They should pay attention and be aware that sometimes DPD can be hard to diagnose. It can be hard to figure out that somebody has the disorder, but it's important to take the time and do a thorough assessment and really try to get an accurate diagnosis.
Thanks for listening. This has been a production of Ars Longa Media. The executive producer is Dr. Patrick Beeman. For more content, please visit our website at arslonga.media. To leave feedback or suggestions, send an email to info@arslonga.media. To find more content from Dr. Grande, including a link to his YouTube channel and his other Ars Longa podcasts, visit our website at arslonga.media. This podcast is intended for informational purposes only and should not be construed as medical or mental health advice. Ars longa, vita brevis.
Welcome to the Bravery Academy. My name is Emma Ferris and I'm your host. This podcast is crafted to share the stories of courageous individuals who've overcome adversity and found the courage to live their best lives. We'll explore the science of well-being, courage and connection, and interview top thought leaders, game changers and survivors. It is from these stories that we learn what resilience is, how to heal, how to recover, and how to be brave.